You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
My name is Mireya Solis. I'm Senior Fellow at the Foreign Policy Program here at Brookings, and it will be my pleasure to be the moderator for this launch event for the book China's Offensive in Europe, co-authored by Philippe Lecorre and Alain Sepulcre. This book offers a nuanced and insightful analysis of a key topic. As the authors put it, China's arrival into the world stage, especially as a global investor, as an overseas investor with expanding reach. And this book looks in particular at China's investment activities in Europe, a topic, I may say, we don't really know enough in Washington, and therefore this is a very timely and needed discussion. Today, Philippe Lecorre will start us off with a presentation of the main findings and implications of his research. So I would like to start first by introducing Philippe, and then I'll introduce my Brookings colleagues who will act as discussants later on after Philippe is done with his presentation. Philippe is a visiting fellow in the Center for United States and Europe here at Brookings. And prior to his time here, he has had a very diverse and distinguished career. He has published extensively on political and economic relations between Asia and Europe. And Philippe started his career as a foreign correspondent, then also was senior advisor of France's Ministry of Defense. He has worked in the private sector, and he has also been a lecturer in very prestigious academic institutions here in the United States and in France. So it is with this wealth of expertise, with this broad perspective, that he brings to us the analysis on Chinese investment in Europe. And I must add, it is a pleasure to read the book. It is well written, it's very accessible, and again, offers multiple insights. Before I move to Philippe, I just want also to point out to you there is another event on China coming up very soon that I would like to recommend. That is the question of food safety in China, and that will take place this Thursday at 10 a.m. But today, we talk about overseas investments by China in Europe, and Philippe, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mireya, and thanks to everyone for being here. I have to say the first thing I should do really is to thank Brookings, the Center on the United States and Europe, and the China Center, both hosts of today's event, and also, last but not least, Brookings Press, which happens to be the publisher of this book. So there are a lot of Brookings today, but, you know, after all, that's where I work now, and I've had a very enjoyable 18 months, and I have to say before we start, I should thank Mireya as well for accepting to moderate this, and my colleagues David Dollar and Constanze Stelzenmüller, who will no doubt offer insightful comments and critical, I hope. But before we start, let me just say that I bear full responsibility for the book's title. So if anybody is unhappy with the title, I'll be happy to explain. I was happy also to hear Mireya's word on the fact the book is quite balanced, I hope. Anyway, the book is mainly about economics. But let me say a few words first, why I did this book, and along with my co-author, who sadly cannot be here. Having spent 15 years as a foreign correspondent in China, having worked in China as a government official, as a consultant with Chinese, I had my first serious conversation about Sino-European relations was in 1994 with somebody I have a lot of respect for. You might know his name, some of you, Endymion Wilkinson, who is a very respected scholar of China and translator of Chinese works, and truly an impressive person, who is still at Harvard's Fairbanks Center. What a lot of people don't know is that Endymion was also the first EU ambassador to China, and he was there for 7 years. He negotiated China's entry into the WTO on the European Union side, and achieved quite a lot during his tenure as EU ambassador. And what did he have to say about Sino-European relations? Well, that it was primarily about business and about European companies talking to Chinese companies. So much for us here covering international relations and diplomacy. But 20 years later, after having met Endymion once again, I embarked on this project to find out, in fact, that a lot of things in China have to do with politics. So if the book is primarily about economics, you'll find out, as I did, that you can never get away completely from the Chinese system. The book is not claiming to be exhaustive, to talk about every country in Europe, to talk about every sector. It's more of an overview, and it's more about the trends and this new phenomenon. What is it all about? Sino-European relations have developed now over the past four decades, but mainly through bilateral relations, really, between China and France, China and the UK, China and Germany, but also, thanks to the double-digit growth that China has known in the 90s, mainly 80s, 90s, and first part of the 2000s, it's developed a very strong trade relationship with Europe. And today, China is the EU's second trading partner after the United States. But I won't cover trade, first of all, because Mireya is one of our best trade experts here. The story I want to talk about today is foreign direct investment, Chinese foreign direct investment. For many years, European companies were dreaming of getting a share of the Chinese market, the consumer market. Some of them have been quite successful. But today, Western investment or multinationals investment in general is in China is slowing down. On the contrary, China has been investing abroad, and this is a very recent phenomenon, as David will probably confirm. It's not just investing in Europe, but pretty much everywhere on the planet. It started with Africa, Asia, of course, Latin America, Australia. And, of course, the main reason for these FDI has been natural resources, the need for natural resources. But what happened during the 90s was very much a competition between Western Japanese, among Western and Japanese firms, for a share of the Chinese consumer markets. Well, today the competition is quite different. People are competing for a share of Chinese money, of Chinese capital. At least that's the case in Europe, where we have the European Union, 28 members, in addition of candidate members that also want to be part of this game. And I'll take a few examples later on. In the 90s, there was a prime minister who was very known to many of you, Zhu Rongji, who introduced, under President Jiang Zemin, in fact, a policy called Zhouqiuqu, which means going out. So that was the starting point, if you want, of this overseas investment policy. And as I said earlier, there wasn't very much of an area that wasn't targeted. So if you look at the map behind me, the graph behind me, you'll see that, let me just see how this works. Yes. You see the trend from the beginning of the 1990s till now. Now, the figures, of course, there are many figures from different organizations, and Overall, it's a dramatic increase over the past five or 6 years. In 2015, last year, Chinese outbound direct investments overtook inbound investments into China. And in Europe, in the EU, it hit a new record of $23 billion, an increase of 44%. Now, this year, there's a huge deal with an agribusiness company called Syngenta. It could be $62 billion in total. And this is just, April, so you can imagine. 70% of the deals last year were made by state-owned enterprises in red. That's something I'll come back to in a moment. And although the U.S. as an individual country has attracted more foreign direct investments than any EU country, the Union as a whole is a bigger destination. Now, of course, there's a combination of reasons why Europe became so attractive. First, in 2008, as you know, the debt crisis struck the EU, and the Chinese government actually called upon the European Commission and offered to buy Eurobonds. It was, at the time, Prime Minister Wen Jiabao, who contacted President José Manuel Barroso and offered to step in to Mr. Barroso's astonishment, actually. And that was an important moment. Until then, there had been mainly, individual companies, mainly private, who had not done very much and who were building their brands and still doing some of them. But the decision by the Chinese government to push into Europe due to this debt crisis, the purchase of Eurobonds, as well as the investment in infrastructures. And, of course, the most famous of all is perhaps the Piraeus Harbour in Greece, which is now pretty much run by Costco as the sole company. That's a fairly new phenomenon. The second reason, perhaps, is a deindustrialization of Europe, which has been taking place. Countries like Italy, Portugal, even France and the UK have had opportunities in many fields: automobile, food, energy, transport. The euro currency, of course, went down, and the Chinese have been helped by this. And of course, these FDIs, as I said earlier, are mainly, due to a political decision by Beijing to deploy capital outside its borders, and particularly in the West. So, of course, there are many reasons. One of them is the acquisition of brands, very important. There are not many Chinese brands that are famous worldwide, but that's one of the reasons why acquiring brands has been one of the ways. It's been also about acquiring technology, but also more generally increasing China's footprints through state-owned enterprises, with the help of state-owned banks and the help of state-owned sovereign funds. So you see where I'm getting. The story of Chinese FDI is also a story of bilateral relations. A few countries have had relations, very strong relations with China over the past many years. Germany, France. France was the first European country to recognize the PRC in 1964. The UK, of course, has had a long-standing relationship with China since the 19th century. Not always good, but anyway, better now, apparently. So there's no doubt that the diversity of countries part of the EU and the history, that the relationship that's been built over the years, has also helped the Chinese to play one country against the other. As I said, many of these countries are now fighting for a share of Chinese capital. China still has $3.2 trillion in foreign reserves, and although two-thirds of this is held in U.S. bonds with low yields, there are huge opportunities for Chinese FDI. So, as I said, reasons for acquisitions of brands, for example, you know, the Club Med, leisure travel company that was bought as a concept for the Chinese consumer, the brand Volvo, the famous car factory, which was acquired from Sweden and relaunched on the Chinese market. There have been many opportunities, really, for China. And the fact the RMB, the renminbi, is now rising versus the euro and the dollar may actually change the situation. If you look at a group like Fosun, which has decided to halt its foreign investment drive, for example, we'll see how long it lasts. China wants to become a global player, and you can see, by the way, the diversity of investments across the EU that is showed on this map. It has encouraged its brands to be quite aggressive, or perhaps offensive. A good example, for example, is ChemChina, which is, you know, originally a chemical company that has invested in a company called Rodia, a French company, actually one of the first investments, but also bought Pirelli, which is a tire manufacturer, for 7 billion euro, and a domestic machinery supplier in Germany, Krauss Maffei. And now it's in the process of buying Syngenta, which is the biggest agribusiness company in the world. And another good example would be Dalian Wanda, which is originally from Dalian in the northeast of China, originally a company in real estate property, which is now investing in entertainment. Now let me turn to the problems that are caused by investments. First of all, job creation. That's one of the mysteries of Chinese FDI. I'm saying mysteries because, you know, when it comes to figures, it's hard to track down the exact number of people that are employed by Chinese companies. In fact, in this country, in the U.S., some people are talking about 90,000 jobs. In the EU, I would probably say perhaps about half. But I have to say, in many cases, there is no clear figure in individual countries, because some Chinese employees didn't seem to be working in different countries. Human resources is a critical point. Just like the Japanese in 1980s, and once again, Mireya might have something to say about this, the Chinese don't seem to trust their local employees, at least not to be at board level or to be in managerial positions. It's still very much, you know, Chinese-run, Chinese-led company with a direct link to the headquarters in China. Many investments are state-driven, as I said, and companies with good banking relationships, of course, get cheap credits. Companies, they spend overseas, but they have benefited from special credit from state banks. As you know, in China, all banks are state-owned. The financial aspect is also critical. You've all heard about the recent Anbang case in with the Starwood Hotel, which eventually saw Anne Bong withdrawing in favor of Marriott. And the reason that was given, although this is more on the U.S. side, but the reason that was given is because the financing part was somewhat obscure to the targets and to the financial analyst community. The properties, the financial side of Anne Bong was not properly documented. There's another problem, which is reciprocity, and I'm sure if there are U.S. Business people in the room, they know what I'm talking about. Western companies or foreign companies are complaining that the Chinese market is not as accessible as it was 15 years ago. The fact there are long list of sectors where foreign investments in China are not welcome. Well, it's not the case in Europe, as you can see, and it's relatively not the case in the U.S. Although you could argue that there's a difference. In the U.S., there's a mechanism called CFIUS, which deals with national security concerns, when in Europe there isn't a mechanism like this. One word on China's image, which is one of the I've actually dealt with that in one of the book chapters, and I see there's a colleague from Pew Research in the room, and I've used many of their charts here. It's quite interesting to see that many of the countries which are prime recipients of Chinese investments have actually the least favorable image of China. So whatever happens, the image of the country, and it's not just China, but in this very case, it's China cannot get away from its image as a country. So it's, you know, which is why it's working a lot on soft power, on its image, but there are problems there. Having said that, many countries don't have a choice. If you take Greece, for example, there weren't many candidates to take over the harbor of Athens. And in fact, they waited about a year before making the final decision early this year. But considering the situation, the financial situation of Greece today, I think actually they were quite happy to have China. Just like Serbia, which is a candidate country to the EU, not a member of the EU currently, which is very happy to find a company and a country happy to build railways between Budapest and Belgrade. In fact, the Prime Minister of Serbia was in this building last year being very proud of it. Now, there's also perhaps one word on the more general aspect of the relationship between China and Europe. Of course, China sees Europe as more approachable, has a better environment, perhaps more open. I don't need to say to people in this room that there are a few entities in this city that are slightly reserved about China as a possible competitor to the United States. Now, of course, in Europe, we are in a very different situation, with many crises, with the migration crisis, terrorism, the euro crisis, as I mentioned. It's in a way, you know, it's a good timing, and the two entities are somewhat matching. But as I said, there are also debates about this, and one of the debates is taking place on the ground. For example, a lot of local officials, elected officials, are facing criticism for somewhat welcoming Chinese investments and putting at risk the factories or the jobs of some of their local companies. So you have a discrepancy between the national level of some of the leaders of these countries that are pretty much all favorable to Chinese investment, and some of the local people, including small entrepreneurs or just members of the general public, that are more reluctant to welcome Chinese investment. You might argue it's just part of a sort of fear of globalization, but I have to say it does have a connection with the origin of the funds. Now, perhaps I should conclude with the big question that some of us are asking. Is there a strategy? And does China have a strategy to take over Europe? And I would say, yes, the strategy has a name. It's called One Belt, One Road. And as those of you who have been looking at China for the past year, and in fact, I believe 2 days ago, an official document was released on One Belt, One Road by the three entities that are running this from China, the Ministry of Commerce, Foreign Ministry, and NDRC. And you know, it's very clear, I'm sorry I don't have a map for One Belt, One Road, but it's very clear that the final destination of One Belt, One Road is Europe, is Western Europe. It goes down, all the way down to Portugal. And infrastructures is the key to this new development. And you know, Europe does need new infrastructures, not just Europe, but the rest of the world. And China has an overcapacity problem. China wants to, has a knowledge of building infrastructures. And that's the way China has decided to develop its international presence. Now, this is the strategy, but China is also opportunistic. So the Chinese are born entrepreneurs, and of course there are many private entrepreneurs that are just deal makers, and they are not part of this strategy. So, you know, I just want to distinguish the fact there is a kind of global concept from China, from the Chinese government, to interact with the rest of the world. But at the end of the day, it also comes down to opportunities. And one opportunity will be the European Structural Investment Fund, also called the Juncker Plan, 315 billion euro, which is basically about revamping European infrastructures. And of course, China is the only country I know of that has volunteered to take part, to join up with some of these countries, some of them, to help responding to tenders and to rebuild some of the update some of the European infrastructures. And finally, I would say the this business of foreign direct investments from China is going to take a new step probably this year through the signature of a bilateral investment treaty, which is also something that's going on here, as you probably know. And this would actually set the rules in many cases, which are badly needed, since, as I said, there is a problem of reciprocity, which is lacking in Europe. And it's about time that things that get a bit organized. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Philippe. That was a great overview. And before I introduce my colleagues, I see a lot of people are standing in the back of the room, and I just want to tell you there are like 6 or 7 seats here in the front. If anybody gets tired, you're welcome to please come and sit here at the front. So I'm going to just very briefly introduce my Brookings colleagues who have kindly agreed to provide comments. David Dollar is Senior Fellow in the Foreign Policy and Global Economy and Development Program at Brookings, and he is, of course, an authority on China's economy, U.S.-China economic relations, He has 20 years of experience at the World Bank. He was the Treasury's emissary in China, working on economic and financial issues. And he has done extensive research on Chinese overseas investment, including in the United States. And David has kindly agreed to share some of those findings to draw comparisons and contrasts to Philippe's research on Chinese investment in Europe. And Constance Stelzen-Mueller is the inaugural Robert Bosch Senior Fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe, also here at Brookings. And before that, Constance was a Senior Transatlantic Fellow at the German Marshall Fund, where she directed the Transatlantic Trend Surveys. And Constance has published widely on transatlantic relations, German foreign policy, defense policy, and international human rights. And she will offer a European perspective of China's economic presence in Europe. So why don't we start, David and Constance, with some reactions to Philippe's presentation and your own comments.
Okay, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Philippe, I enjoyed the presentation very much. I think there's a lot of important work here. I was asked to complement Philippe's presentation by talking about about China's investment in the United States. I might have one or two little disagreements that'll emerge along the way, but I wasn't specifically asked to critique the book.
Okay? Please.
Which would be hard because we agree probably 85%, so I'm happy to compliment, okay, in both senses of the word. So I want to make three points. The first is a point from macroeconomics, so I think a slightly different perspective than what we heard, which I hope is insightful. I think there are very important macroeconomic reasons why China is emerging as such a big investor in the world. China's growth model in the recent past has been very, very heavily dependent on investment. China's had an extraordinarily high investment rate, up as high as 50% of GDP. It's also a country with a very high savings rate, also in the ballpark of 50% of GDP. And a few years ago, China was largely using that vast amount of savings to invest domestically and drive its growth. But when you invest at that level, what I think inevitably happens is you get very serious problems of excess capacity. And that's what's happening in China's domestic economy now. They've overbuilt the capital stock. There's lots of empty apartments, enormous excess capacity in steel and other manufacturing sectors. They've overbuilt infrastructure. And in that environment, it's natural that profitability declines and investment growth slows down. So just think of there being a lot fewer good investment opportunities in China. Now, the savings rate is gradually going to come down as China turns to be a more of a consumer society, but that's going to be very slow. So what's happening in the last couple years is investment is slowing down a lot more than savings are changing. And so a lot of this savings now is looking for investment overseas. So I want to emphasize that economic fundamental. I see this as not primarily a cyclical phenomenon, might be a little bit cyclical, but mostly this is structural. China is going to be investing a large amount of capital overseas every year. The Institute for International Finance estimates that last year the net capital outflow was $676 billion, which is an extraordinary amount of money. And if these recent trends continue, China will replace Japan as the largest creditor in the world within 5 years, net creditor, largest net creditor in the world. So I first want to emphasize this macroeconomic foundation of what's going on and the need to invest a vast amount of money overseas. That leads me to my second point, which is where we may have a little bit of disagreement. I see most of this capital outflow as commercial, not strategic or political. So you do have these strategic initiatives like One Belt, One Road. It's defined in different ways. So if you define it to include all the investment in Europe, then, of course, it's big. I've had officials in China tell me it includes investing in the U.S. and Canada. Of course, it includes Australia. Of course, it includes Africa. So if investing in the whole world is One Belt, One Road, then we can say this, what we're discussing is One Belt, One Road. But I think of the initial One Belt, One Road ideas much more narrowly, an effort to build infrastructure in the nearby developing countries around China, Central Asia, also Southeast Asia, perhaps some in Russia. And so my second point is, none of that is going to be big enough to absorb $600 billion per year in investment. So most of this investment is going to go to the big capitalist economies. That's what's happening now. Aside from Hong Kong, the U.S. is the number one destination, as Philippe said, as a nation. Australia is number two. The United Kingdom is number three. Other important, you know, Germany, France are among the top 10. Canada's among the top 10. So if you look now, after a number of years, where is this stock of Chinese investment according to China's statistics? Most of it is in the G7 countries, to be frank, and then you throw in Australia, and you get a large fraction of that. So I see it largely as commercial. Initially, quite a bit of it, as Philippe said, was directed at natural resources. Frankly, a lot of those early natural resource investments have not worked out well. China does not have as much need for natural resources as it did before. So the more recent trend is the diversification that Philippe emphasized. So if you look at the United States, which I said is the biggest destination, you've got investments like buying the Waldorf Astoria, a movie chain, a mid-sized bank in California, the largest U.S. pork producer. So I don't see much strategy there. I see diversification, which is a smart strategy for a very big investor. Now, it's true a few transactions into the U.S. have been interfered with by our Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., which looks at national security issues. But I would emphasize that while the Chinese get quite exercised about this, there's only a tiny number of transactions that are reviewed by CFIUS every year, about 120 from all countries. You know, maybe 20, 25 of those are Chinese transactions. So I think in practice, this is a pretty small interference. And, you know, according to most data, the U.S. and Europe are both big, open economies. So it's not surprising that a lot of this Chinese investment is coming to Europe and the United States. The third point I want to make is I think the issue Philippe highlighted of lack of reciprocity, this is a big issue for the United States. The OECD carries out a ranking of investment openness, and they do it by sector. You know, both the U.S. and the EU are measured to be extremely open, which I think is the reality. China is the most closed of G20 countries. So it's not just more closed than the EU or the U.S. It's more closed than India, Russia, Brazil, South Africa, just to name a few. And that's because China's pretty open in manufacturing, but it's largely closed in financial services, telecom, logistics, a lot of agriculture. If you look at a lot of recent deals in the U.S., Chinese firms buying U.S. companies, the analogous deal in the other direction would not be allowed. You know, so China bought the largest pork producer in the U.S. Would have made more sense for our pork producer to invest in China. It has better technology, food safety, brand, but that's not allowed. So it's good, acceptable second best, you know, to have the Chinese company take over the U.S. firm. But frankly, it creates an unfairness in the market. And I think it's a pretty serious problem that what's becoming the biggest investor in the world is actually quite closed itself in many important sectors. It would help China's reform if it would open up those sectors. A lot of the sectors I mentioned are service sectors. This is the part of Chinese economy that's growing. So it would set a very good foundation for all our relations if China would open up. As Philippe said, China's negotiating bilateral investment treaties both with the EU and Europe, both with the EU and the United States, excuse me. But my perception is this is moving very slowly, and it's difficult to get a good offer out of China, an offer in which it promises or commits to opening up most of these sectors, perhaps with some delay. So I think that's an important issue we need to keep working on with China, getting them to open up and create a more level playing field among these big economies. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. Constance?
All right. I am actually really not in a position to talk about the German-Chinese economic relationship much, because that isn't my expertise. As those of you who know me know, I'm just not credible on that. What I think I can usefully do is to talk a little bit about the political and geostrategic ramifications of this relationship, which are considerable and which have produced some rather interesting wrinkles in the German-Chinese relationship in ways that I think are worth looking at more closely and that are perhaps unique in Europe. Philippe, I commend you not to just read this book, but go buy it in the bookstore, which is on the other side of this room. And it is indeed a very good read. And as you will see from that and from the graphs that Philippe showed us, Germany is actually not the most important locus for Chinese investment in Europe. China has been luckier, say, in the UK or in Italy than other places. But the trade relationship is extremely important between the two, and the Chinese have moved up. Germany's prime bilateral trade partner, of course, is the Eurozone, always has been, presumably will be. After that, traditionally, immediately came the United States, and that has been replaced a year or two ago by China. Those two have switched places. And as you would expect, there is a bit of an internal correlation between Germany's trading and investment relationship and Russia and the Chinese. As in recent years in particular, the relationship with Russia has gone down, the importance of the relationship with China has increased, both economically and politically, for Germany as an export-driven nation, which, I mean, literally, its entire prosperity and indeed much of its soft power depends on exactly that. So you might say, to put it a little bit provocatively, that China, after the EU and the transatlantic relationship, is Germany's biggest power source and multiplier. That means something. That said, there is a great deal of ambivalence to the relationship, and that also is worth exploring. Like in Russia, the German business community has had some wake-up calls in its engagement in China. It's run into bureaucracy, into corruption, into all sorts of unpleasant experiences, many of which you can find detailed in German reports. And I've brought a study with me, which is published by none other than Huawei, which is perhaps is unsurprising. It's called Germany and China, Perception and Reality. Presumably there's an English version of this as well. And it has some very interesting numbers on German and Chinese perceptions of each other and corruption, bureaucracy, the general difficulties of doing business in China figure quite largely in there. And the study is useful not least because it questions not just the general German and Chinese public, but also political deciders and business deciders. Huawei's European center or European center of business is, as some of you will know, based in Düsseldorf. That said, I think that we were discussing earlier about the role of Huawei in Europe. I think that there is still a certain degree of cautiousness in Germany and particularly among German politicians on engagement with Chinese state-owned companies, particularly where the degree and the consequences of the state ownership aren't always entirely clear. And that brings me, of course, to a very key point, which is of enormous concern to German businesses, which they don't like to talk about in public, but they are quite voluble about in private, and that, of course, is economic espionage. I'm not going to suggest to you that Germans never do espionage. We learned in the wake of the NSA scandal that Germans do espionage too, and I'm not going to be virginal about this. But the reality is that Chinese business espionage is extensive, in-depth, creative, imaginative, and it is a source of enormous concern for German businesses. And not only that. The Germans, in general, I think, were somewhat late in the day to recognize the importance of cybersecurity, not just in their business affairs, but also in their government affairs. And part of that was in response not just to a sustained onslaught of cyber attacks from parts east of the EU, but also from parts very far east of the EU. So these things have begun to somewhat flow into each other in the mind of German policymakers, and as a result, the Germans have upgraded their capabilities quite substantially from what was indeed a very low level of capability not very long ago. The interesting aspect that I would like to okay. reference as in my last point about the German-Chinese relationship is, of course, an ambivalence about one's own power and the sustainability and viability of its sources and what that means for one's relationship in one's immediate neighborhood, but also in global affairs generally. I'm not going to suggest that Germany and China are exactly like each other in this respect. The differences here are more important than the similarities. But the degree to which there is a sort of a worried self-examination, I think, in both cultures is interesting. A degree of consciousness of the perhaps unsustainability of one's power sources, or perhaps a degree of fragility. Yeah? In Germany, I think German policymakers are profoundly conscious of the fact that they were lucky in the last global economic crisis, and it's not entirely clear to them that they would be this lucky again in the next one. And of course, contagion, even if we come out well or came out well in the last one, contagion still has an impact within the European Union. And we are, of course, conscious as well that China's role in its own neighborhood has an impact on our trading interests in that same neighborhood. So while we are rightfully accused of not being particularly geostrategic about Asia, we have a strong, strong sense that our trade flows there and our investment in the region are of crucial importance to German national interests, and that we need to improve our strategic analysis and our strategic abilities on that account. Finally, perhaps one last point about German perceptions with regard to China's global role. And is that, and again, this brings me back to the Russia topic. There is a strong sense in Berlin, I think, in recent years that Russia has become, from a country that could be a partner, to a country that is mostly a challenger and dismayingly, increasingly a spoiler. China is in a different category. The Chinese clearly are challengers to our transatlantic partners in the Far East. To the extent that that has an impact on European and German trade interests, that is of strategic interest to us as well. But there appears to be a willingness in Beijing to consider a Chinese role in the management of global affairs that appears to have disappeared in Moscow. And that, I think, is the key difference, as seen from Berlin, between Beijing and Moscow. Again, nobody, I think, is naive about China's activities in its neighborhood or about the state of the Chinese economy or, indeed, of the state of Chinese democracy. But this perception of China as a strategic actor that is concerned about the viability of its own role is one that I think meets with great interest in Berlin and is one of the reasons why the Merkel government, I think, has already been to Beijing 8 times, taking, I think, every time 2 or 3 government planes, full not just of most of the cabinet, but of most of the DAX 30 CEOs. And that's what I have to say for the moment.
Thank you very much. This has already been a fantastic set of presentations. And before I ask some questions to the panelists, I wanted to give Philippe the opportunity to react to the comments. And in particular, I think that we already put the finger on what I think the question that is in everybody's mind, what is driving Chinese investment? Is it a commercial logic, or is it a geostrategic political rationale? And I think we have 2 different views here. So, Philippe, how would you respond to the comments made so far?
Well, to David, I'd like to say that maybe it's largely commercial. Chinese have needs to invest, and it's also part of their status as a the world's second largest economy, and the fact their companies have been growing, and as we know, the Chinese GDP growth for the past 35 years. Has been stunning, and the general story of China for the past 30 years has been stunning. On Europe, the point I'm making is there's a region of 500 million consumers. The EU may have a lot of flows, but it has a unified, it's a trade bloc, Now, of course, the problems of having regulations and taxes and things like that, you know, many foreign entrepreneurs or many entrepreneurs may not like this. But once you're in these trade blocks, and once you're accessing this market, you can actually get quite a lot of benefits. So I'll just take the example of Eastern and Central Europe, which is an interesting part. Now, of course, if you looked at my map earlier, as David said, the top recipients of FDI are the top countries as well. But there's a story, there's an upcoming story, which is this area. First of all, I'm going back to the Greek story, because this area is going to be really interesting in terms of China developing a platform from on the Mediterranean Sea all the way up to the Balkans and part of Eastern Europe and possibly North Africa. That's one thing. But if you look at Central and Eastern Europe, there's a new mechanism called the 16 plus 1, which China has introduced, of engaging with 16 Eastern and Central European countries. Some of them are part of the EU, some are not, which is, my dear colleague from the Europe Center might agree with me, it's slightly puzzling to some European officials. But anyway, what I'm saying is, by using some of these countries as manufacturing centers, and the target is really West Europe, not East Europe, and on One Belt, One Road, and in particular, the idea that Central Asia and South Caucasus, these places might be of interest to China in terms of using the overcapacity for infrastructures. Yes, but what about the consumers? Where are they? They're not in Kazakhstan with 17 million people, which is, by the way, the biggest Central Asian country. They are in Western Europe. And at the end of the day, one would have to, you know, explain where all these trains and planes and ships are going to go to, because, you know, we can go around circles, but, you know, one belt, one road, it might be a belt, but at the end of the day, you want to sell Chinese products to someone. And just one word on the perceptions. The German story is quite incredible. The fact that Germany and China has been such strong trade partners for 30 years that the Germans have invested so much in China, not just in factories, but also in human capital, in you know, sending students to Germany, engineers, doctors. Still, it's the country that has the lowest approval rates of China as a country, if you look at you know, the Pew Research. Yep. And you know, and I've attended conferences in China with German colleagues, and they still don't get the China story, if I can say it's a bit simple. But you know, they still don't understand why China is China, and you know, maybe after a week they get the idea. But you know, there are a number of thoughts that coming up to a highly educated German mind, which is, you know, the environment, human rights, the one-party rule, and all these kind of things that don't work well with welcoming Chinese investments. Having said that, I mean, it's still happening, you know, but it's an interesting case.
Thank you very much, Philippe. Let me ask you, all of you, just one question, because I do want to bring the audience. I'm sure there are tons of questions from the people gathered here. And, you know, from everything that has been said today, it just reminds me how important it is that we update our views of how China is integrated into the world economy. Because some of the conceptions we have are clearly outdated. China is no longer, you know, the last lower-end, labor-intensive cog of a global supply chain, has moved from there. China is not going overseas just, you know, for the search of natural resources. As we've learned from the presentations today, China is investing in industrialized markets. And I like a phrase, because I think it captures this very well in the book, Philippe. You say that it has gone from made in China to made by China. And a driver of these investment strategies is acquisition of technology to develop innovation potential. So my question is to all of you, what is the scorecard here? is China really making significant progress? And in particular, because I can think of very substantial inertias that militate against innovation, both country factors and corporate factors when I think about Chinese multinational corporations. What I have in mind, for example, is restrictions on inward FDI that David referred to, right? If you want to bring technology, one natural way to do it is actually to invite foreign capital to the homeland, and it seems that China is not doing that as much as other countries are doing. Then insufficient protection of intellectual property, insufficient rule of law, limits to the data flow, information flow, all these things that we associate with innovation, with creativity, with dissemination of knowledge. And then at the corporate level, one of the things that I really enjoy in your discussion in your book, Philippe, was this talk about corporate governance in Chinese multinational corporations and how some of these corporations that have gone overseas nevertheless remain very much in the family. You have familial structures and you have hierarchical corporate governance structures where you make a reference to the fact that it's very difficult to have contestation of ideas within the corporation. And again, that seems to me militates against innovation. So we know that there's a new driver for Chinese investment. Is it paying off? Is it enough to overcome these other factors that I have highlighted as obstacles to the achievement of that goal?
David, you want to?
Okay, I'll lead off. So China has been spending a large amount on research and development in recent years, and there are a number of achievements you can point to. There are lots of process innovations in China, you know, where China absorbs existing technologies and makes modifications. And I think there's some product innovation in solar panels. You know, so to be fair, you've got some successes. But as a macroeconomist, I feel the overall effort is unimpressive in the sense that China spends a lot on R&D, but the macro indicators we use, total factor productivity growth or more micro, you know, high-value patents, it's just hard to find a lot of output from that effort. So I, without repeating what Maria said, I share your concern that issues like intellectual property rights, freedom of the press, freedom of information, all of that hampers an innovative culture. Mm-hmm. So the interesting question is, as Chinese firms buy, in some cases, high-tech firms in Europe and the United States, you know, will those firms continue to have innovative cultures? How will the Chinese management mesh? And I have an open mind about this. And to me, it's too early to have any kind of conclusions about this. Like, there can't be anything like a serious study because so much of this is just happening in the last 2 or 3 years. But it will be a really interesting thing to follow.
Yeah. Thank you.
You know, it's... I'm still thinking about what Philippe just said in response to my remarks and whether there really is sort of a distinct difference between Germany, say, on the one hand, and France and the UK in their relationship with China. And again, I don't, you know, I think that German business is just as eager to get into bed with non-Western big business opportunities as anybody else. Yeah? I mean, I don't want to be pompous about this. And this is certainly, again, the more true, the worse the relationship with Russia gets. That said, for all sorts of cultural reasons, most of which I think are blindingly obvious, the Germans have had a felt a need to emphasize things at the same time, like rule of law, education, as it were, or rule of law conversations. And that, I think, is not just sort of airbrushed on top of what is essentially otherwise a geoeconomic relationship, but that is a very sincere concern because there is a conviction in the German system, among German policymakers in particular, that an economic transformation that isn't accompanied by a real political transformation, even if you don't apply to it the standards, say, that you have applied to new European democracies post-fall of the war, even if you don't apply those standards, there has to be also a political transformation. Otherwise, such economic transformation is liable to be both unstable and not reach as enough people. And there, I think it's fair to say that Germans are concerned and do still voice a great deal of distrust. And one of the merits of this Huawei study is that it articulates that in numbers and shows just how little mutual trust there is. And that's been, as you said, reinforced by the Pew study and also by the study that I used to run for the German Marshall Fund, the Transatlantic Trends. I would like to make one additional point, though, and which hasn't been mentioned here yet, and that is that I find an interesting Chinese concern is the viability of the EU as such. While the Chinese are perfectly happy to play us all against each other in the bilateral trade relationship, as to the degree that that is useful, they are also actually quite concerned that the EU might explode. And I'm not suggesting that this is for any particularly high-minded reasons, that this is because Beijing or policymakers in Beijing think that the EU, you know, is a shining city upon a hill, a utopia to which one should aspire, this kind of thing. But the reality, of course, is that if the EU continues to stick together, it continues to provide a single market. A single market is a good thing to trade with. And I can't tell you how often I was called when I was still living in Berlin by the people I knew at the Chinese embassy who said, can you please come in and explain to us about Ukraine? And isn't that really dangerous to the whole EU, you know, project? And should you be as fussy about Ukraine as you are? And then I would explain that this is actually a fairly important concern. It was clear that this was not persuasive. But I learned from that something rather interesting, which is that there is an interest in the survival of the EU as a functional entity that I think you don't get in Moscow, and indeed quite the reverse. That's I think a significant point in our relationships with the Chinese.
Very good.
Just one point on this, and then I'll try to cover your question on corporate governance. It's interesting, really, that for the past year, we've heard the Chinese Premier, Li Keqiang, speak about Grexit, and the Chinese President, Xi Jinping, talk about Brexit. And I'm sure you're all familiar with these terms, but one is about Greece staying in the EU, staying in the Eurozone, in fact, and Britain is about, and the other one is about Britain staying or not in the EU through the referendum that's taking place on Jonathan Pollock's birthday, June 23rd. Sorry about this, but I just thought about it. It's very unusual for Chinese top leaders to comment on other countries' important political events, especially when they have to do with elections or referenda or discussions among European leaders. Anyway, on Miria's question, I do believe there's a problem of the corporate governance of China. I mean, the word governance is not understood the same way if you're in China or if you are elsewhere. And of course, one of the reasons is that as you saw earlier, the vast majority of OFDI from China are, in fact, from state-owned companies, and some of them are pretty badly run, let's face it. And of course, they are run as entities of the Chinese Communist Party or the Chinese state, and their leaders are appointed just like if they were senior officials in a provincial government or in the central government. So it's difficult for some of these companies, and some of are well run, but some, as we know, they've been merging for that matter. So, for example, Costco, which is the largest shipping company, has recently merged with another entity, and it's the company that's running the harbor of Athens. And so, but it's not going to change the fact that. It's not going to be run with Greeks, and any takeover from Chinese entities into Europe has not led to having more Europeans as part of the board of directors or anything like that. In fact, I know of some detailed cases of Chinese takeovers that have led to the European directors to be asked to leave and to be replaced by Chinese directors. So, I mean, this is going to be an issue. The only company, the major company I know of that is truly international perhaps is Lenovo, that has 50% of its board members international, including the CEO, who was an Italian, and who is based in Beijing, but was previously the leader of Lenovo in Europe. This is going to take a long time, and the Japanese were there before, and so it's possible it will happen, but my feeling is that it's going to take a very, very long time.
Thank you so much. So let me bring the audience. Thank you for your patience. I know there are tons of questions, so I'm going to take three questions, and please take notes. The problem with having so much expertise is that we may not get beyond those three questions, so please, very concise questions. Bruce, and then Kawazan, and then the person next to Kawazan. And if you can identify this gentleman. Bruce, can you stand up so that he can see you? And please, very concise questions, concise answers from my fellow panelists.
Just a question for Philippe, if he could. Bruce Stokes, the Pew Research Center. Philippe, if you could speculate a bit about the political implications of Chinese investment in Europe on the forthcoming decision about market economy status for China. Especially in light of at least the anecdotes that some European countries that get a lot or get from their perspective or hope to get a lot of Chinese investment have blocked in the past anti-dumping measures by the European Commission.
And then right here, Kawase-san, can you raise your hand? And then.
Hi, my name. My name is Kunihiko Kawase, Embassy of Japan. Thank you very much for very useful discussion today. Here I would like to refer to the newly the announced Department of Commerce statistics for the FDI in the United States 2015. The United States accepts $380 billion US dollar in the year of 2015. Out of this $380 billion US dollar, China's share, China invested $2 billion US dollar, so 2 out of 380, while the Japan invested $36 billion US dollar, Germany 25, France 25, UK 11. According to the Mr. Lucor's chart, the Chinese share in the world FDI was 10%. This is my understanding. So if both statistics are right, then the U.S. is the, much more lower than the average. Assuming that the statistics are right, what might be the good explanation for that? Thank you very much.
Thank you. And the gentleman next to you.
Thank you. Alan Fong, China Daily. What effects would a Brexit have on Chinese investment in Europe? And are there any particular sectors that China's invested heavily in? And if so, which and why? Thank you.
Okay, so who would like to take first? Who have comments for those questions?
Well, I think why don't you let Philippe go first? Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to say something about the U.S. one in a moment, okay?
Well, on the market economy status, I mean, obviously, it's not going to be that easy. First of all, because I think China is starting to realize that there's something called the European Parliament, where there are lots of debates there. Now, the big issue, of course, that it's on everybody's mind is the steel issue. The three factories that were closed in the UK, steel factories. And the fact that there will be job losses, an additional 15,000 job losses, would China get this market economy status? So I think it's going to take much longer than that was expected. It's interesting to see how China behaves in that context. Originally, they were just dealing mainly with. The executive branch in Europe, and then now suddenly they've realized that that it's not. Despite all what I said, which is I hope overall positive about the Chinese presence in Europe, there's also a sort of downside that a lot of people feel worried about dumping and about. David spoke about the. Solar panels. I mean, I'm not going to tell you the whole story of the solar panels, but that was a kind of war between Europe and China that has left some stains. And Constanze mentioned Huawei, which now has about 25% of the whole telecom market in Europe, you know, with a lot of government help and not as a free marketer, so to speak. So, you know, there is some concerns about this. And just one word on Brexit. Well, if Brexit takes place in June, China will still be in London, but they will certainly reconsider, I bet, some of their investments, long-term investments, because obviously they will not have the access to the European Union markets they would have if the UK was a full member of the EU, and particularly the nuclear plant project might be in question. So I guess it's hard to speculate, but it's not going to be good for foreign investment in any case. But the Chinese are, as I said earlier, are interested in the European Union market because it's a large consumer market, you know, it doesn't mean they'll give up the UK entirely, but it's not going to be the same story.
Yeah, so I think we can agree that there are quite a bit of problems with Chinese statistics on their outward investment. Even if you look at their own sources, their Ministry of Commerce data, you're somewhat inconsistent with the balance of payments data that come from the central bank. They report in the Ministry of Commerce data, they report half of their outflow of direct investment, 56% actually going to Hong Kong. And I'm sure there's a certain amount of Chinese investment in Hong Kong, but probably vast majority of that is transit investment that goes on somewhere else. And again, if you look at their statistics, big places for their investment are the Cayman Islands, Panama, and you know, probably most of that is actually transiting on. So the best I can say here is it really would be in the interest of the U.S. and China to work together, get better statistics, and find the ultimate, you know, beneficial owners of the investment coming into the U.S. The $2 billion figure you cited from the U.S. side, that just seems too low, frankly. Okay. Now, you'll also see some accounts in the media where people just add up all the transactions they hear about. That's not scientific because some of those transactions fall apart. And the headline number, that's not direct foreign investment, you know. So, you know, it is an area where the U.S. and China need to work together and, you know, probably EU and China need to work together to get better statistics because it is hard to know exactly what's happening. It's higher than that figure you mentioned, but I'm glad you brought it up because somebody up here, I think, should have said that, you know, while it's large and growing, it's not that overwhelming amount of finance that, you know, you might get the impression that China's buying the whole world, and that's certainly not indicated by any of these different statistical sources. 4.1? Well, that sounds potentially closer to reality, okay? So, you know, it's significant. But as you say, it's smaller than what Japan is doing and some of the others. I emphasize that China would end up being the biggest net creditor in the world. That's a pretty safe prediction. But I also emphasize that China itself is very closed, and it's actually not getting that much inward investment anymore. Countries like Japan, most of the European countries, they get a lot of inward investment. They have a lot of outward investment. You know, that's the nature of advanced capitalist economies.
Okay, now let me go to this side of the room. I have this lady here, and if there are no questions on this side, and then the gentleman, and then if we have time, this lady.
Thank you. My name is Sharon Wu. I'm with the Economic Department at George Washington University. So my question is, we talk about a different type of capital flows, and here we talk about FDI, but FDI seems to be the most stable type of capital flows of all, and past experience show that it is quite beneficial for receiving countries. So I think, do you think that the capital flow, the FDI from China to U.S. and Europe, is kind of different? Does it also promote the growth and employment and, you know, the spread of knowledge in these receiving countries? And also, I think maybe this kind of surge of Chinese investment is just cyclical because the exchange rate of China was very high before, but now it's kind of going down. So maybe it will naturally decrease in size, so it's not a big concern.
Thank you very much. So very concise questions, please, from the gentleman with the glasses.
Thank you. George Chedishvili, Carnegie Fellow, Georgetown University. So my question, it might be very generic, so I hope it will be like an easy answer. Do Chinese leaders and financial leaders attach any ideological dimension to their growth and their international trade and investment? So one of the speakers mentioned about kind of compared China with Russia. In Russia, I know it does attach. It has kind of this idea of Ruski Mir based on orthodoxy. And is the Chinese growth generally can be branded as like anti-Western, just like is the case in Russia? And if it is, like to a certain degree, what will be the implications for the future trade? Thank you.
Okay, and last question from the lady in the front with the orange sweater. Please, very concise, and we'll go to concise answers too.
This is Haiyan Wang from China India Institute. This first quarter, we saw a massive rise. Even if you take out some of the big deals, it's still very massive. What has been driving this certain urgency and this rapid growth? Do you truly see this growth trend continue over the next 5 years, given very high corporate debt ratio, given very rapidly rising non-performance loan of the state banks? So what do you believe could be, as you said, Dev Dollar, that China could become the biggest creditor? Do you truly believe that trend to continue?
Thank you very much. So 1 minute answers and, from the panel. Whoever wants to
Well, I'll just take the first question. No, I mean, I agree with you. FDI, you know, is all for growth, and it's beneficial to an economy or whatever it is. There's no doubt about this. I would say, you know, one probably have to distinguish between M&A and greenfield investments. It's not the same idea. The Chinese are very good at making deals, and for example, in this country, they've been doing a lot of property deals. David mentioned the Waldorf, and there are many, many others. I think the real concern is really, as you know, in many countries, employment is a great issue, and to commit to the long-term economy of a country, you need also to translate that into jobs and into long-term, you know, engagement. I mean, it's not just a Chinese issue, but since we're talking about Chinese FDI. At this very moment, we're not sure whether job creation will follow this commitment, this interest, because if you look at other parts of the world, in fact, if you look at Africa, which is arguably quite different, there haven't been that many job creations. There have been, you know, many projects, and sometimes built by African workers, but more often built by Chinese workers. A number of Chinese have stayed in Africa, but I'm not sure it's translated into concrete help for the African economy. I think that's enough for me.
So the reason I think it's very likely China will emerge as the largest net creditor is that, you know, some of the uncertainty from last year has died down. Capital flows have stabilized. They're not at the kind of alarming level we saw at the end of last year. But they're on target this year to be in the range of about $500 billion net capital outflow. That's with China's economy stabilizing, doing pretty well. I think the bad scenarios all lead to more outflow, right? So I'm not sure if China will succeed in stabilizing. It may very well have a sharper slowdown. You mentioned the problems of debt. There are a lot of reasons why the economy could get worse in China. That would almost certainly lead to more capital outflow, and that's why I feel pretty comfortable saying this is likely to happen, because if things go well for China, you'll probably see a stable $400 or $500 billion per year flowing out. If things go south, then certainly over the next few years, you'd see even bigger numbers. And all of that gets you to, you know, China being the largest net creditor in about 5 years.
Right. I'll focus on the second question since nobody's addressed that. I get the sense from my conversations in Beijing and with Chinese diplomats and think tankers is that the Chinese, somewhat unlike the Russians like to think of themselves as still part of a bipolar relationship. It's Russia and America, nothing else matters. Everybody else should get out of the way or, you know, fall into one of the two camps. I get the sense that the policymakers in Beijing think of themselves as part of a strategic triangle, you know, which has, and that of course speaks to the global creditor role that's already been alluded to of Beijing by you, and in which of course the EU is of interest strategically as a way of balancing out America, you know, and possibly keeping America in check. Hence the interest in the sustainability and functioning of the EU. Within the EU, Germany is of interest, and I think it fascinates the Chinese, at least that's the impression that I get, because of what they see as our success with what you could call, and again, I'm trying to put on a Chinese pair of glasses here, managed capitalism, yeah, and managed growth and managed change. I think that is what we are seen as the primary address for. There are other things that the French do or that the Brits do that are far more interesting than what we do, and banking, for example, certain kinds of state-owned industries, et cetera, that's other countries are of interest there. But the managed change part is what we're there for. But I fear that our Chinese partners refuse to see the role that cultural, social, and political democracy plays in that. It's the thing that is routinely discounted in this conversation by our Chinese friends, that they think is essentially an appendix that can just be removed when translated to the Chinese strategic environment. And that is, I think, the fundamental misunderstanding, or if I want to be rude, the mistake that Chinese policymakers are making. And that is in itself a limitation on the depth of the relationship. Mm.
Just one final word on
sure.
this. I mean, it seems obvious to me that the Chinese leadership cares a lot about growth because in China, everything is domestic, and what the Chinese government is doing is primarily for its domestic audience. So it's possible that some of the deals that were done for opportunistic reasons by a particular entrepreneur. But as I said, many of these investors are state-owned enterprises. So I think, you know, if you put yourself if you put the glasses of Chinese leaders on your nose, you might want to ask yourself, how am I selling these Chinese overseas investments to my audience, to the Chinese people, at a time when the economic growth is actually much lower than it was, and when, you know, as we know, there are many problems in China, there are many problems everywhere, but it is an issue in the run-up to the next party congress, in the way that China has been dealing with its. With its population and you know, a number of people looking for jobs and things like that. It may not necessarily help the Chinese domestic economy. It could, but it could not. It's an open question.
Thank you very much. We have come to the end of our time. The conversation will continue. I'm sure that Philippe wouldn't mind addressing some of your questions individually, but also because you can buy the book. It has come to you. I think there's a table with the book at the back of the room or the library as you exit Brookings. I want to thank the panelists for sharing their insights and to take the opportunity to congratulate Philippe for the publication of this great book.